Thank you. This, what I'm going to say is an excerpt from an upcoming book that that should be out this summer that I'm writing on the Cobra Movement, basically focusing on the years of Cobra, 1948 to 51. And the last chapter is on the problem of expression and the relationship to expressionism, which I think has been completely misunderstood in relationship to Cobra. So that's this is a small part of that chapter. The idea of expression in art suggests that the artwork externalizes thoughts and emotions internal or unique to the artist. But there is nothing direct or simple about the notion that a physical configuration of matter can encode or transmit ideas and affective states. And this when you were talking about music earlier, this is very directly related to the problem in music as well. The Cobra Movement drew directly on Northern European expressionist precedents, along with surrealism, in their approach to expressing both emotional and rational, including social and political content in art. Cobra, formed in Paris in 1948 by artists from Copenhagen, Brussels, and Amsterdam, included both founding members like Asger Jorn and participants in its early exhibitions like Ernest Mandoba. Unlike earlier expressionism, which presented an individual subjective viewpoint on the outer world, Cobra artworks foreground the process of expression as an intersubjective link between artist and observer. The artist emphasized that what is expressed is always shaped by the observer as much as the artist. When Jorn titles his Cobra period painting Wounded Wild Animal, he relates the emphasis on vivid color and brushwork that resembles children's finger painting to a subject of expressive pathos. And I know these are very small, so I hope you can see them. However, smaller symbols on the edges of the picture suggest the way reading spirals outward depending on the observer. We may interpret the flower or flame held by the animal, or possibly a brush in its hand, the small pregnant female figure on the left edge of the picture, or the generalized presence of the red color, not within the animal itself, but in the background of the picture, suffusing the space around the animal in many different ways. It's not clear what the cause of the trauma is or whether this animal is threatened or threatening. It is an emotional expression, but one where the symbolism of the images depicted continually points to multiple conceptual readings. The images themselves are only half formed in the material intensity of the paint itself. The central image plays on the myth of the expressionist artist as a traumatized subject, but marginal figures suggest an expansion of that trauma beyond the confines of the figure into the wider culture, in which the figure has been reduced to what Jorn called the human animal. I should also say this is not any identifiable animal. It's an amalgamation. It's a monster of different animals. In the terminology of Cobra's political manifestos, it was the outrage of social inequality and political violence that oppressed this figure as much as any sense of internal angst. The picture was part of related to Jorn's series of war visions, paintings that responded to the threat of the Cold War as much as the recent experience of the tragedies of World War II in Europe. Mangoba's early painting from Paris features an aggressive mask form emerging from stark patterns referencing Kuba masks from Congo, Kota reliquaries from Gabon, and Tosa beadwork from South Africa, all transformed into a European-style modernist personal expression. As Rashid Areen observes, as we've heard about earlier, he calls it an abstract expressionist work. And for the purposes of my talk discussing, it is an abstract work, it is an expressive work. So I'm going to go with that interpretation just for the moment. It's characterized by an all-over composition, as Areen points out, meaning it covers every surface of the canvas, every corner is covered with imagery. It's not just something, a mask in the middle. It breaks down the divide between figure and ground. It is not, in fact, a mask, but a flattened pattern that transforms the potential meaning of masks in a new cosmopolitan interpretation of the community they symbolize. It points to this kind of potential community. Mandoba proposes a modern Pan-African community in his synthetic image. The aggressive colors and striking patterns of Mangova's early composition, painted soon after he met the Danish artists, are also in direct dialogue with the abstract painting of Ferlov and her Linnean colleagues, which depict abstract brush marks and symbolic shapes in equally vivid colors. And I should say, this painting on the right, I think, was formerly attributed to Mangova, but it's actually Sonja Ferlov, and Troels Andersen has verified. We kind of reattributed it in the process of when I was writing about it a few years ago. So now we think it's Sonia Frolov's painting from 1938, and this was the year that they met. They both depict abstract brush marks and symbolic shapes in equally vivid colors, equally intense brushwork. The composition rejects the representational Christian imagery and carving techniques for which he was successful in South Africa in favor of painterly abstraction as a language both modern and universal, or at least potentially. His very appropriation of the implicitly European language of modernism as a black artist makes a profound claim for its universality. The painting is comparable to Mark Rothko's early abstract expressionist work in his myth-making phase, except that Rothko focuses on Western classical imagery, and the colors feature this tone of emotional restraint. Both painters actively question traditional mythic symbols and express a kind of ambivalence toward a shared cultural heritage. Mandova's composition boldly questions the very possibility of art symbolizing any specific cultural identity. Rather than a single cultural expression, it presents real cultural unity as artificial if not foreclosed, along the lines of Jean-Luc Nancy's description of the inoperative community. The modern artist's search for an idea of community made inaccessible by modern society and capitalism was especially politically charged for artists of color attempting to establish recognition for their own marginalized communities in places like Paris and New York. The all-over composition of both practices generalizes artistic expression so that it is no longer linked to a subjective interpretation of a scene. Instead, it develops in the abstract play of color, line, texture, and form, or more literally, transformation. In the mid-century period, this type of abstract expressionism was unequivocally linked to the rise of US political and cultural dominance and its Cold War claims to freedom of expression after the Second World War. In this movement, based on an art of generalized expression, expression dispersed across the canvas as a free set of signifiers. The politics of interpretation replaced an overt politics of the representational image. This meant that the authenticity and potential universality of the expression was interpreted by critics as most effective when produced by subjects already considered most capable of it. Abstract brushwork and even references to African traditional decorations could literally be made by anyone. The final meaning of the image was displaced onto the action of producing it, in this conception of action painting, and therefore onto the artist as actor, and note that actor is already a masculine term. Before specific artworks were evaluated, unspoken biases framed who was the proper agent of expression. Critics sought out and celebrated works by white and male heterosexual artists who positioned themselves as outsiders to high culture. Even with a growing number of abstract expressive paintings by women, queer artists, and artists of color proliferating right under their noses. These are just two American examples, an African-American queer artist on the left and Lee Krasner, a woman artist on the right. Expressionism throws a wrench into the process of aesthetically evaluating art that may have no more visually in common than an underlying attempt to express emotional affect, this kind of intention. Whether we're talking about expressionism, cobra, abstract expressionism, or neo-expressionism. Not to mention children's art, outsider art, folk art, and other forms closely associated with direct or so-called authentic expression. The attempt to express emotions directly leads artists to make work quickly and therefore to continually risk sloppiness and failure. Yet the very emphasis on authenticity of intent over finished product radically destabilizes aesthetic value judgments, leading to repeated crises about how to differentiate good from bad painting. The problem of how to judge personal expression foregrounds the question of how artistic professionals, like myself and some of us here, decide what art is good. What emerges over time is the fascinating way that our own values shift the more we study expressionist art. I have frequently come to see great value in cobra artworks that I initially dismissed as poorly conceived or executed. The challenge of expressionism pushes our criteria of value from preconceived ideas of development and finish toward a recognition of the complexity, provisionality, and relativity of all judgments of artistic value. 20th century expressionists proclaimed that their movements were not based on style, but rather the authenticity of what Kandinsky called the inner need for expression. Similarly, in Cobra, no one style unifies the wide range of work produced by the different artists. The Cobra idea of expression is also no longer a revelation from inner to outer. Instead, the artist considered art a material means of connecting actively with other people, as well as the non-human world. The desire for connection was termed empathy in German expressionist theory. For Cobra, it became a search for something more material and populous, which Asger Jorn called a common human expression. Sonja Furlov-Mankova used the phrase allmenngeldende Uttryck, literally a generally applicable expression or just expression for all. Expressionism and Cobra responded to the social alienation of living in a complex and specialized modern society, characterized by inequality, migration, colonialism, and war. The Cobra artists attempted to create a populist understanding of expression that was ordinary and childlike, but also unique in its material manifestations. Their idea of authenticity was about engaging with a culture in a specific moment, rather than channeling some unique inner talent. Cobra moved away from the idea of self-expression through its emphasis on spontaneity, because it depended on the unexpected. Spontaneous expression could not be authentic to any pre-given meaning, not even an unconscious one. To create an artwork spontaneously meant improvising, acting semi-consciously, as opposed to the conscious presentation of emotion in expressionism or the unconscious channeling of the psyche in surrealist automatism. It meant acting in a particular material and location, in a particular material, in a particular location in space and time, in a specific context defined culturally and intersubjectively. These contextual links are often what the Cobra work actually expresses. The Danish artists of Linnean, the pre-Cobra movement of the 1930s, interpreted expression as a way of connecting people in a socially progressive approach. Furlov recalls her time in Linnean as a search for humane expression in the midst of an inhumane society. It was natural for people to work together in a group that was based on a common understanding of life, a common content, she says. I mean people who can meet in their quest to reach a human expression that can have a common human meaning and help in the struggle for a society where the individual can preserve his or her personality as a human being and each individual human being can live in humane conditions. Danish spontaneous abstraction was an organic and holistic approach that viewed the artist as integrally connected to society. Its humanism was inclusive rather than exclusive. Eiler Bille described the group's goal as a living human expression. Jorn echoes Bille's views, writing that abstract art is not an isolated formal investigation, but rather an art about human experience. Abstract art, Jorn argues, is not an oppositional art like Dada, but rather a positive, life-giving art. It is easy to establish who is recognized for producing such a life-giving art, not the female artist who actually produced life, like Furlov, who her identity as a mother was highlighted by Christian Dotremont, the founder of Cobra, in his Cobra book on the artist, but it was actually a kind of subtle dismissal of her seriousness as an artist, in my interpretation. It was the male artists and the white artists who fit the established image of the avant-garde provocateur. They also had the connections to promote their work as innovative and, in the Danish discourse, life-giving. The most celebrated expressionists were all male and European, in part because the very notion of artistic genius was a European idea linked to masculine subjectivity. Feminist scholarship definitively exposed this bias in the 1970s, but its implication for expressive abstraction has yet to be taken fully into account. Gaining control over emotion itself continues to define adult masculinity and whiteness. The male European expressionist artist's mastery over the appearance of affect, a culturally feminized and racialized domain, allows him to convey a universal humanity beyond his own identity. Whiteness, upper class status, and heterosexual masculinity are all defined categorically by emotional restraint. Expressionism meant artistic mastery over the signs of affect, conventionally linked to color, texture, and organic forms in art. Expressionist artists attempted to convey universal experiences beyond the specificity of their own identities. But biases about gender and sexuality, race, and class proved impossible to set aside. When the white artist regards African art as, in the words of Fauve artist Maurice de Vlaminck, the expression of an instinctive art, the black artist is reinscribed as a creature of instinct, therefore incapable of mastering artistic expression. Women artists were similarly barred from artistic mastery, since femininity was encoded for centuries of European discourse as an inability to distance oneself from emotions and bodily processes. Male expressionists went to great lengths to establish their virility in the early 20th century and not be taken as feminine, resulting in what Carol Duncan describes as the hypersexualization of female images, in order to counter the effective associations that threatened to associate the male artist with feminine weakness and slavery to natural instincts, as critics described it in the early 20th century. As soon as art became about personal expression, it became an aggressive and masculinist language. As a primitivist wallowing in sensuality, it became a white interpretation of a stereotyped black subjectivity. The white male artist could embody femininity or blackness, but not the other way around. Picasso states in the 1930s, "What is important in art is not a canon of beauty, but Cézanne's anxiety, Van Gogh's torment." Anxiety came to define human subjectivity in the modern period, more generally, at least in Europe. However, to recognize the anxiety of a black artist would have meant empathizing with the potential causes of the torment, which would point directly back to the discourse of white privilege in the era of colonialism, an ideology that everywhere depends on the invisibility of whiteness. What happens then when artists base their expression primarily on the material dynamics of color and brushwork? The abstract expressionist or cobra artwork related to the mastery not of a single emotion, but a generalized affect no longer attached to a particular subject. At a time in history when affect was once again socially reinscribed as a feminine area, men struggled to reassert control over their emotions in cultural archetypes of the West in the 1950s, like the traumatized war veteran of film noir, or the James Dean-style outsider figure on which Jackson Pollock modeled his own artistic persona. As Sarah Ahmed writes, being emotional comes to be seen as a characteristic of some bodies and not others through specific cultural processes. Cobra produced its expression through a raw or brutal, relatively direct presentation of artistic materials. The Cobra founders Jorn Dautremont and Constant, as well as Carl Appel shown here, critiqued the way artistic institutions codified expression as a personal discourse of talent and virtuosic skill in the era of Cold War liberalism. Pollock was the most famous example of this professionalization of personal expression. Radical experimentalism and artistic provocation were central to their avant-garde project, but they were not Cobra's only tactics. In the work of Elsa Alfelt, Sonia Furlov, and Ernest Mantlova, the quiet rhythms and multivalent artistic forms, often characterized by emotional restraint rather than strident aggression, refute the spectacular brutalism of the male and European Cobra artists. All the Cobra artists valued folk and non-Western art, along with ancient art from Europe, as outsider creations that stood for a spontaneous and an anonymous expression. But they noted the ways that such expression is always precarious. Furlov writes, "There will always be critics who make it into a special, individual, and fantastic expression instead of an expression for all." Her observation echoes Constant's 1948 declaration in one of the Cobra manifestos that every limitation that reduces art to the reserve of a small group of specialists, connoisseurs, and virtuosi must be removed. The Cobra artists wanted art to be inclusive rather than exclusive, common rather than elite. They produced what I call an interpersonal expression rather than a personal expression, meaning one potentially open to anyone, based on a simple transformation of materials into symbolic images. The meaning of these images relates to people's experience as part of a community rather than the expression of individuals set apart. So you see in this 1950 sculpture, Mankova getting even more abstract, you know, and moving to a quieter, more restrained kind of expression, more akin to the painting up here from 1950 than the earlier composition. Furlov's sculpture, for example, features a quiet restraint and aggressive presence that only emerges after slow looking. It does not shout. It exudes a solidity and strength that I believe were necessary for Furlov to counter existing attitudes about women artists and develop work that could claim a greater universality of human experience. The Mantlovas radically transformed European primitivism into its opposite, global humanism. They expressed their interest in pre-Columbian American and traditional West African sculptural forms through their own personal visual and sculptural languages, But instead of reinscribing racist assumptions about the people who made such works, they propose new interpersonal connections between the anonymous traditional artists and the modern subjects who engage with these works, i.e. with us. Both Furlov and Mantlova synthesize references to traditional pre-Columbian, African, and ancient Scandinavian art in order to further strengthen their claim to a cosmopolitan universality. But their political position was minoritarian, opposed to the elitist cosmopolitanism of European humanism that defined the 1950s. And my big example of this is the writing of André Malraux, who Mankoba quotes in the beginning of this text. But nevertheless, they were all reading Malraux. I mean, he's, of course, Voices of Silence, the Musée Imaginaire, but his kind of humanism takes global cultures and talks about them as individual expression without naming the artist. It sort of subsumes global art into this individualist European modernist framework. And I'm arguing that their framework was minoritarian because they weren't concerned with this kind of transcendence of individual expression. They were trying to do something else. Humanism as an individualist discourse founded on the classical Western heritage, an inherently colonialist vision of universalism was starting to collapse. The reactions the Mantlovas received as an interracial couple, combined with their personal refusal to play the aggressive game of artistic self-promotion and their artistically nuanced critique of primitivism in solidarity with colonized people, have all shaped their historical marginalization in the story of Cobra, even as the male Cobra artists have been praised for their aggression, for their mastery of artistic signs of affect. Completely overlooked by contrast are the tactics used by the female and black Cobra artists in appropriating the dominant forms of emotional restraint to make their work into an equally balanced and multifaceted common human expression. The Danish Linnean artists critique the racism of European culture in the 1930s, likely inspired by Mankoba. I'm running out of time, okay. and it was through their close friendship when they met in Paris 1938, Mankoba came to regard Billa as a brother in spirit, as he said. It stood out against the broader lack of understanding he encountered in Paris, where he says only a few were ready to draw the consequences of their admiration for African art in the more general consideration of the one who made them, the African man. So I'm going to skip ahead here. When Hoest and Cobra joined in Copenhagen in 1948, Mantlova hoped that the new art would be able to express the feelings and struggle of all races, he says. But the solidarity of Hoest quickly fell apart over debates about abstract versus representational painting methods. Mantlova was left out of discussions and treated, as he recalls, like the consort of a European artist. Even though the European artists declared their solidarity with outsiders and the oppressed, their view of the world was radically different from his. The Dutch Cobra artist declared in this interview their desire to liberate people from the slave society we live in. In the same interview where Mantlova is forced to defend his work from the interviewer's assumptions about the primitivism of African culture. It's the very first question. How do you relate to traditional primitive African cultures? He describes immediately becoming a black artist at a time when every trace of the original African cultural foundation has disappeared. So he situates himself as a modern artist in sympathy with post-colonial developments, which he followed in the news over the decades and talked about in numerous interviews later. So I'm going to skip that quote. So his composition foregrounds a spontaneous and vividly expressive interpretation of symbolic forms that openly questions the meaning of African art in the modern era. When they return permanently to France, I'm just going to end on the Ancestor series because I wanted to get to this transition to his mature art that we see reproduced here. They live in a small secluded town for 9 years, starting in 1952. The intimacy of the family became the microcosm of the human connection they sought to express in their art. And he says that their very conception of mankind and art not only contributed to their isolation, but invalidated them in the appreciation of the official art world. That was Mantlova's own analysis. And he transitioned in this period toward the series of Ancestor paintings. These are works that remarkably channel his profound disappointment at contemporary race relations into images of global unity. So this humanism becomes stronger in his work instead of, you know, the anger that I think that could easily be read into this early painting. It is a reading of that painting. So his experiences mark the history of his own people And he says in the late interview, the word Fingo, he's a Fengo artist, means wanderers. And he talks about his family history and relationship to that. And so the ancestor is a representation of that. But as Winnie also notes, it's a global ancestor. And he says it unites us all. It's not just linked to that. It's both particular and universal at the same time. And this is really the last point that I want to make. He's synthesizing references from traditional African arts from all over Africa, as well as European references, European modernism. The calque-malerie, or bad translation, is chalk paintings on pagan images and early Christian images on Danish churches that he saw in Denmark. I think this is key to his transition toward lighter colors. They're almost chalky, pasty, lightly applied colors. And he synthesizes these in this kind of cosmopolitan imagery, along with Ferlov, who synthesizes references to African, pre-Columbian, modernist sculpture altogether. So they're trying to transcend their own experiences with racism and political incarceration in Mantova's case by developing cosmopolitan expressions of shared humanity. In the 1960s, the figures become more open and transparent. The face in these works appears to float lightly, almost ghost-like, in a lively, expressive space. Mantova refers to the image as our ancestor, which represents our humanity, a sign of a heritage which we've forgotten. And I had a discussion here of universality. If you read a lot of contemporary theorists, Slavoj Žižek and Susan Buck Morse in her writing on Hegel and Haiti, they talk about how universality is an expression of, it doesn't come out of some romantic belief in our shared humanity. It comes out of a discussion of the universality of struggle. And the universality is something we strive for and make a claim for out of the particularity of these struggles. And I think the Mantovas were very attuned to these, you know, parallel struggles among, you know, different peoples in Africa, different peoples in Europe, around the world. And so this, they create this new expression of universality that is completely, again, it's not, I don't see it as a romantic vision, because if you read their interviews, they're not romanticist at all. They're very attuned to the reality of what is happening in Europe, and they're extremely disappointed with what happens in Europe after the war. But they create these images as a kind of hope, as a kind of claim for universality. So I'll end there. Thank you.